The World's Fair Podcast, Episode 6. In this episode, we celebrate Vancouver's Winter Olympics by looking back at when the city hosted Expo 86 24 years ago. Our guest is Bill Cotter, who's written a book about Expo 86. We talk about the Expo, the city, and the legacy that the Expo has left behind, including much of what you'll see during the Winter Olympics. Hi there, and welcome to episode 6 of the World's Fair podcast. Before we get started, I have a bit of an apology. This podcast doesn't quite live up to the audio quality standards that I had hoped to maintain, but the conversation is really great. So without further ado, I will present to you a bit flawed episode 6. Hi there, and welcome to episode 6 of the World's Fair podcast presented by Expo Museum. My name is Urso Chapel. I'm here in San Francisco, USA. My co-host is John McGregor. He's in Brisbane, Australia. Hi, John.
Hi. Hi, how are you? So how are you?
Pretty good. Well, you know, this week, most of us have been watching at least a little bit of the 2010 Vancouver Olympics. And for World's Fair fans, the Olympics can be the next best thing to an international exposition. I know that I never miss the opening and the closing ceremonies, and there are many commonalities between the spirit and the goals of the Olympics and World's Fairs. I suspect, John, you sort of have that same relationship with the Olympics?
Yes, well, Brisbane has actually gone for the Olympics quite a few times because we had the Commonwealth Games in 82, we had Expo 88 in 88, and when you've hosted an event like that, inevitably you want to be able to host an Olympic Games as well, and I think in Canada's experience with Montreal having Expo 67 and then getting Expo and then getting the Olympics in 76. The Olympics and World Expos, World's Fairs, have so much in common that if you do one, you inevitably want to do the other as well, you know?
Well, the modern Olympic movement's first games, of course, were held in Athens in 1896. But not many people know that the second and the third games were held at World's Fairs. In 1900, Paris hosted the Exposition Universelle, which was the second one to use the Eiffel Tower. And then in 1904, St. Louis hosted the Louisiana Purchase Exposition and then also held the 1904 Olympics as part of that. So, you know, in many ways, the World's Fairs provided a sort of springboard for the modern Olympic moment. So,
yes.
So, you know, watching the Vancouver Games this week, you know, I realized that fans of Expo 86 are going to see a lot that's really familiar. You know, the opening ceremonies were held in BC Place, which is the site of Expo 86's opening ceremonies. And the symbol of the 2010 Winter Olympics is based on the Inukshuk that was given to Vancouver for the Northwest Territories Pavilion and then moved, I believe, to Stanley Park. And now the Olympic logo is sort of based on that. So there are so many connections between the two. You know,
can I just say something very quickly, Urso? It's very interesting you mentioned the Inukshuk because actually for World Expo 88 in Brisbane, in front of the Canada Pavilion, there was a stone Inukshuk as well.
I didn't realize that.
And that sort of like became a symbol of the Canada Pavilion at Expo 88. And at the end of the expo, it was moved to the State Library of Queensland, where it was there for some time. So it became a permanent souvenir of Canada's representation at Expo 88. So it was very interesting when I saw the Inukshuk as the logo for Vancouver 2010. It's exactly the same.
Wow. Well, you know, so because of the Vancouver Olympics going on now, it made sense for us to talk about Expo 86. And I can't think of anyone better to talk to about Expo 86 than Bill Cotter. He's literally written the book on the history of Expo 86, as well as tons of other World's Fairs. I'll let you tell you more about himself and some of his projects. Hi there, Bill.
Hi, how are you guys doing?
I'm doing really great. You know, during the Olympics, I get that extra bit of energy. It's almost like a World's Fair, but it's, you know, I can
come home from work and watch it on TV and get a little bit of that sort of, you know, World's Fair slash Olympic spirit in.
Yeah, I've been enjoying watching it right from the opening ceremonies, and we have the high def and been enjoying it. It's almost like being there, but it's a lot warmer on this side of the screen.
Yeah, well, not in the opening ceremonies. It sounds like they were all very warm inside that covered stadium.
Yeah, it did seem that way. It's been kind of interesting watching all their worries about whether or not they'll have enough snow for the events and having them truck and helicopter it in. It's certainly been a challenge for them.
Well, so I mentioned that you had written a book about Expo 86. So if you could tell us a little bit about that and some of the other books and projects you've been working on.
Sure, yeah. I was really pleased to be able to do it. Expo 86 has remained one of my all-time favorite World's Fairs. I've been lucky to have gone to a number of them in different places. And Expo 86 was one that just, it still set a high weather mark for me in many regards because of the participation of the people from across Western Canada that that all joined in for it. I've been looking at various pictures. I collect them as a hobby of World's Fairs. And besides my own, I've been buying other people's collections and adding to it. And kept looking at different things, and every time you look at it, you remember a little bit more, and you talk to your friends about it. So I proposed to the publisher, Arcadia Publishing, that they might want to do a book on Expo 86 and tie it into the fact that Expo and that's going to be on people's mind as they go to Vancouver for the Olympics. And happily, they agreed and came up with the usual incredibly tight deadline, and off it was time to put the book together. And really, really enjoyed taking a trip back in time myself to 1986.
I've been looking through your book and actually going through my old guidebook, which is very weathered after 24 years, and some of the other material that I've collected from Expo 86. And it's, for me, I was 19 years old, and I had grown up in Atlanta, and I'd been in, throughout the Southeast and the Midwest, but I'd never been to the West Coast before, and I saved up money and flew myself on this red-eye flight out to Seattle and rented a car and drove up to Vancouver and only got to spend like a couple days because I was definitely on a budget. And it's amazing how those 2 days just have so many memories for me. And going through the book, I can remember, oh, yes, I didn't have time for that pavilion. And then I remembered everything about every detail of the ones that I went to. And it really is such a riveted expo in my mind. And it's amazing how much has stuck with me 24 years later, and here we're about to come up on the 25th anniversary. And,
yeah, I think it was a real energy charge fair. Coming after the sort of disappointing one before it at New Orleans that a lot of people didn't enjoy, and I happen to enjoy New Orleans myself as well, but I think Expo just kind of had a spark from it from the moment you got there and you saw. Maybe it was all the flags they had flying all over the place or the colored banners or anything, but it was just, to me, a real visual treat for the eyes. And there was always something, getting your attention, looking over to the left, down to the right, what's going on over here? And, you walk out of there at the end of the day just absolutely drained and looking forward to going back and doing it again the next day. It was just, to me, wow, just a great time.
So, watching the Olympics on TV, I'm also lucky enough to have a high-def TV, and I watch them on my TiVo, so I can, pause it and look at every single detail of every frame. And if I suspect you're probably a little bit like me, you're looking for all the Expo 86 artifacts in the background. And, when I've been to Vancouver since then, I'm always sort of seeking out the leftovers of Expo 86. So, what can you tell us about what's sort of the legacy, the physical legacy of Expo 86 in Vancouver? Because I noticed that you mentioned that in some of the things in your book.
Yeah, it was one of the things that I appreciated that Vancouver didn't turn its back on the fair and just say, okay, it's done, tear it down and move on. And like if you go to New Orleans today, you cannot find any mention that they ever had a World's Fair there. Knoxville, if the Sun Sphere wasn't there, you'd be hard-pressed to tell there was a fair. A lot of cities do the fair, they tear it down, they move on. With Vancouver, it was kind of a mixture between the two. There were certain things like Expo Center that they had plans from the beginning of retaining, they never had plans to use the site as a giant park like Robert Moses wanted to do for the New York World's Fair. But I think what was nice about X46 was that they dispersed so much of the pieces of it across such a wide area that you can go to a water park, and there's part of X46. You can go walking along, and there's park benches from X46. You can go over to England and, you know, ride the monorail from X46. There was just lots and bits of pieces of it that are still there. And as you said, when I'm watching the Olympics, I'm looking at the little filler footage that they do, as you know, in between events, and I think I remember that, and you know, rewind it and try to look at it. And it's kind of fun to see how much of it is still identifiable.
You mentioned that monorail. You know, we have a lot of listeners that are fans of theme parks, so I was kind of happy to find out that the monorail still exists, and I believe you said it was at Alton Towers.
Yeah, it was funny. I used to travel to Europe quite a bit. I had a job that took me over to Europe about once a month. I did that for 10 years, and we spent a lot of time. And one time we were on vacation and took the family, and we said, what do we do today? Well, we'll go out to Alton Park, and we were out there, and I said, God, this monorail reminds me so much of one I've been on before. It's just like the one, and trying to think, oh, yeah, it's like the X-86 one, and I didn't even realize it at the time until I got home and did some checking and said, oh, my God, that is the same monorail. You know, I thought it was maybe the same manufacturer. I had not realized when I was on it was actually the same monorail. It was kind of a real surprise to have seen it again. So sort of like meeting an old friend.
That's really funny. You're talking about monorails and recycling things from expositions. I think it's common for other expositions too. Certainly with Brisbane, there are some things like the Nepal Peace Pagoda. There's South Bank Parklands, which used to be the Expo site. There's the Expo Symbol Tower, which were kept. But also, it's very interesting that we kept our monorail too. And the monorail from the Expo ended up being sold to a hotel on the Gold Coast, Jupiter's Casino. So it's very interesting. They don't like to completely get rid of the monorails. It seems they put them into use elsewhere.
Well, I still keep hoping. I live in Los Angeles these days, and I keep hoping someday that somebody will come to the wisdom of putting monorails down the middle of the highways, because it seems to me to be the only way we'll ever clean up the traffic mess that we have out here. So I have been in love with monorails ever since the AMF one at the 64 World's Fair, and I will go out of my way to ride one and enjoy it. And again, it's just a real kick to see one of these things still around so many years later.
Well, yeah, as a San Franciscan who goes to LA a lot, I'm really hoping that this high speed rail actually gets to be put in, because having a rail connection between San Francisco and LA makes all the sense in the world. And you know, this is a little bit off of the theme of the podcast, but I know for myself, you know, someone who goes to Anaheim at least once or twice a year, you know, it's just to be able to get down there in just like a matter of hours without having to like show up an hour and a half before the airplane takes off and going through security and things like that. I'm really hoping that happens.
Yeah, it makes a big difference.
Speaking of Anaheim, part of X46 is in Anaheim at Knott's Berry Farm.
Yeah, the Spirit Lodge, and that was really just one of the high points of X46. It was interesting at the time. People were going crazy trying to figure out, you know, the technology used behind it. And it wasn't really all that tricky, but it wasn't the technology that made it special. It was really the story. And I think that's what really worked for me on so much of X46, is that people didn't try to outdo each other with, you know, gigantic pavilions and massive amounts of this and that. A lot of the things, if you look at Rainbow Wars or Spirit Lodge or the various things, that the films had real heart to them, and they were telling stories, and it wasn't just the technological gimmicks that I think sometimes companies try to outdo each other with. I think that really helped. The fact that the space available for each pavilion was fairly limited, because this overall site was fairly small, meant that people could really put more money into their shows than into the temporary buildings to build them, tear them down. The money went into content rather than just the construction.
Yeah, well, you know, a lot of those films were in the Canadian Pavilion, which was Canada Place, which, you know, is another Vancouver landmark that you see over and over if you're watching the Olympics. the big white sails of Canada Place on the waterfront are everywhere, and they're actually lit up with the Olympic colors for the Olympics. So it's another situation where a little bit of Expo 86 has been contributing to the Olympics. It's been really exciting to see.
Yeah, the whole Canada... Go ahead.
No, it's all right. So just very quickly, you were mentioning Canada Place. That used to be the Canada Pavilion, wasn't it?
Yes, that was built to be the Canada Pavilion. And
yeah, it was one of the ways they actually got the World's Fair built, because they wanted to go and build a port and a convention center, and they were trying to figure out what to do and how do we fund this thing. And that's how you end up with the sort of strange topography of the site, with the two different parts of Expo 86 connected by train, was that they always wanted to have the Canada Pavilion survive after everything else was torn down, the temporary stuff along False Creek.
I think this is true, that one of the theme songs from the Canada Pavilion, Canada, This Is My Home, ended up being one of the theme songs of the Canada Pavilion at Brisbane's Expo 88 as well. Wasn't that song from Bob Buckley the theme song of the Canada Pavilion? Is that right, Urso?
Yes, and actually, I didn't tell you this, but I corresponded with Bob Buckley today by email.
Oh, really?
Because I was asking him for permission to put that song at the end of the podcast, and he was happy to let me do that.
That's such
very funny that you said that.
Yeah, that is such a wonderful song. I mean, listening to that, "Oh Canada, This Is My Home," it makes you feel wonderful to be a Canadian, even if you're not a Canadian. You know, it's really amazing. It's very it's very stirring. And it was a great part of the Canada Pavilion's popularity at Expo 88 as well. It was just wonderful.
There was another film, though, that I remember looking at, and you might remember better, Bill, that ended up at Epcot.
Yeah, the Canadian, there were some modifications made there. It wasn't just they showed it there for a bit of period of time. It wasn't part of the permanent Epcot, repertoire.
I would be remiss without mentioning that the for our listeners who are theme park fans, that the Scream Machine from Expo 86 ended up at Six Flags Over Mid-America, which is now Six Flags St. Louis, and was the Ninja. So if people have ridden the Ninja, they've perhaps inadvertently ridden an Expo 86 legacy site. And
quite a few of those thrill rides got transplanted to various Six Flags. I think they must have done well at the salvage sale.
Yeah, and then the looping starship, which like a lot of the Six Flags have, ended up at Astroworld, which sadly is no longer around. But it was kind of nice to sort of see that like little parts of it got spread out. So
I'm not a thrill ride goer, so I think those are one of the things I skipped at Expo 86, and I'll skip them if I come across them again.
Yeah, well, it's funny. I like thrill rides, but I've never ridden a thrill ride at a World's Fair, because when I'm at a World's Fair, I want to get down to business. And I figure I can go on a roller coaster anytime, but I, can't go into an Estonian pavilion every day.
I worked on Space Mountain at Disneyland. I think that put me off them after you get ride the thing testing. After a while, you don't want to ride it again.
Well, I have to say that Space Mountain is one of my favorite rides, so. So tell me about your own memories of Expo 86 and the things that you remember the most.
Yeah, the thing I really liked, as I mentioned earlier, was I'm a visually oriented guy. I look at things too often through the viewfinder of a camera, and try to figure out how to frame the picture, what do you look for, and what makes it interesting. And you go to some places, and it's really kind of hard to find the right angle. Back in the days of Expo 86, of course, it was all film. And I hate to think, how many rolls of film shot and the amount of money spent taking pictures, and there was always something else to take. Having worked for Disney for a number of years, I became pretty well sensitized to, doing things like line of sight and how do you do queue management for attractions so that people don't realize they have an hour wait in front of them, and there's always something to entertain them, every 7 minutes so that the line seems shorter. And I think that people that did the job for Expo 86 really excelled at that. There were some long lines for attractions, but there was always something going on, whether it was you know, the street performers. They had so many of them out there just entertaining, you know, people out between the pavilions. There was musicians, you know, jugglers, you know, clowns, all sorts of things to keep you entertained. And that, to me, is my biggest memory, is that time just flew by, that, you know, the weather was nice most days, not always, but even on the bad days, I can't ever recall just being bored or when will this line ever end. It, to me, it was just like, wow, where did the day go? It really flew by, and that's my biggest impression of the whole thing, was just energy coming at you from many, many different directions. You know, pavilion-wise, there were some I enjoyed more than others. There were some that, you know, disappointed me more than others. But just as an overall impact, I just think the energy level at Expo 86 was supercharged. It was nonstop.
Well, the site was sort of interesting in that it was along False Creek, which was, I think, basically shipyards, and there wasn't really much of anything of note there before the Expo opened. And I remember it's a very linear site. There was a definite sort of a direction that you went back and forth throughout the site. And I just remember walking through it, and it just kept going and going and going. You know, it wasn't the largest site in the world. It was kind of a standard for an expo. But because it was all sort of laid out linearly, it just seemed like it went on and on and on. And I think the things I remember about it were the sort of the color themes. Because the different sections were themed on colors, and then there were different plazas that were themed on different types of transportation, because, like we should have said earlier, transportation and communication were the theme. So there was lots of different, I mean, everywhere you looked, there was like, you know, a half of the front half of a 747, and then a truck sticking on a pole up in the air, and then, you know, and then they had the Apollo, Soyuz module at the Soviet pavilion, and, you know, it was like, there was all kinds of very interesting things, and everything was extremely colorful. I mean, you think of the 80s.
And they had, I should mention, also in front of the Australia Pavilion, they had the yacht that won the America's Cup in 1983. They had the Australia 2 just right there in front of the Australia Pavilion as well. So just tying that in with what you were saying.
Well, that was a big deal at the time, because the keel of that had been such a big secret. And, you know,
that's right.
Well guarded, and here it is out with everybody going around taking pictures of it, and, you know, it was kind of fun to see the reaction to you know, people saying, boy, it's, you know, pretty plain design. And go, yeah, it may have been a plain design, but it sure won the race.
Yeah, the secret winged keel, yes.
Right. Yeah, the thing that's interesting about Expo is it started off to be a transportation exposition, and it was supposed to be a much smaller thing in a totally different part of the city, and then when the site got picked along False Creek, it really gave them a challenge, as you said, or so it was one long, you know, section. And they came up with the color scheme, which most people don't realize that the color has actually progressed in the same, you know, natural progression as they would if you looked at the light through a prism or along a rainbow, that the colors change from coolness to warmness as you move, depending on the direction. And I think that helped people because it gave you, rather than the sense of one giant indigestible fair, how do I see it all? If you were going there in days, you could say, well, we conquered the blue zone and we conquered the purple zone, and tomorrow we're off to the yellow zone. I think it let people kind of gauge themselves, that knowing that this was not an insurmountable task, that if you properly allocated your time, you could see most of what you wanted to see. I think that really was a very, very clever idea by the fair designers to break it into those distinct segments like that.
Yeah, they did that actually. It's very funny that you mentioned that. And with Expo 88, they learned quite a lot, or they borrowed quite a lot from previous expos, especially Scuba Expo 85 and Vancouver 86. And since you're mentioning that Expo 86 was color-coded like that, they did the same thing with Expo 88 in Brisbane as well, where the actual concrete was painted different colours according to what zone you were in. And, you know, there were shades of green and blues and reds and so on and so on. So maybe they picked up on that idea from Expo 86.
Yeah, I really think it helps because it puts it into more human-sized terms rather than this big monstrosity out in front of me. I'm at yellow, and I know where yellow is, and it's on the map, and I can digest that I've seen yellow, and now I can move on to green. And I do think that helped an awful lot. I had been at Expo 85 over in Scuba the year before, and the color code certainly helped me. Not my Japanese is near non-existent, but it was certainly easier to get around when you could realize, again, the color mythology that they used. It helped me get back to my my ride home at the end of the night, if nothing else.
Well, you know, what, you know, gearing up for Expo 2010 in Shanghai this year, I keep looking at these maps and Section A and Section B and Section C and wishing that they had done some sort of color-coded system or something. Because, you know, if 70 acres is hard to break down into parts, digestible parts, I'm just trying to imagine what 1,300 acres is going to be like in Shanghai.
Yeah, I'm getting my, what you call it, comfortable shoes ready for that one. One other thing that helped at the Expo 86 site, too, is that they realized, you know, if people go all the way to one end of it, you know, getting back to their car or their train or their bus at the other side is going to be a bit of a challenge. So they used False Creek to their advantage and put water taxis and things like that along that, you know, you could start at one end, work your way to the other, and not have to turn around and hoof it all the way back through the crowds like you were a salmon going upstream. You could ride the monorail back, or you could ride the Skyway back, or you could take the water taxi back. So you could actually make the going home part of the trip, you know, yet another event in itself. And I think that was another smart thing that they did.
You know, one of the things I do remember from it as an 18-year-old, you know, transportation was part of the theme, and then you actually, there were lots of different modes of transportation to get around the site, and even examples, you know, being shown. So it became part of the expo. There was you mentioned the monorail, and then Vancouver's own SkyTrain system, which you'll see often during the Olympics, was built in time for Expo 86, and they had a separate ticketed area that connected up the two parts of the expo site using SkyTrain, but also the Japan Pavilion had the HSST on display and even running, so you can go back and forth, showing that technology. And then I remember even France had a little people mover system running.
And that was a very strange transportation system.
Yeah, I remember enjoying the aesthetics of it, but wondering just what its application would be.
Yeah, for people that weren't familiar with it, it was basically like a little booth that you got in. It was on a track, and they pulled you along the track, and you got to the French Pavilion and got off. Well, it was nice, except on a hot day, the little glass-covered cars got to be very, very warm indeed. I imagine on a cold day, they would have been kind of uncomfortable. But they found out that you can only pull things by a cable for so long before you start getting into the principle that the amount of energy needed to pull these cars becomes inefficient. And it didn't do well at all with hills. They found trying to get it to go around curves was next to impossible. So I think they only built two of them in the real world, and I think only one of them is still running. And, you know, like, again, it looked really nice. And I'm an engineer by trade. I looked at it, and I just said, I just don't see this one making it. I might have been a little bit more, you know, enamored, you know, because Disney, we had the people mover with its, you know, maglev motors and all the rest of it, and thinking, well, this, you know, our system, of course, could go anywhere and do anything. I can't believe they're pulling this thing on a rope. It was like looking at a giant ski lift.
I remember it was definitely a different kind of looking technology, because it was sort of a greenhouse on rails, and it had a sort of curved side, and then and then where the door was a straight sort of straight glass side. And it definitely was something unlike any other technology you'd seen. And
I liked it because you could take pictures up there, and you get some different camera angles, and the glass, you know, part made it interesting. But once I rode it, it was also nice to know you could see the rest of the French Pavilion by going up a staircase and not having to wait on the line for the people mover again.
Well, and the other thing I remember was that there were ads on the outside promoting Paris's bid to host the 1992 Olympics.
Wow.
That's funny. I don't recall that.
Yeah, they had like a stylized Eiffel Tower, and it was Paris trying to get the 92 Olympics, which, of course,
that's very interesting. So. That's very interesting, also, because actually Brisbane went for the 92 Olympics as well.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
We must have been competing with Paris also. You know, Barcelona got it in the end, of course, but it was very interesting because the Lord Mayor of Brisbane during World Expo 88, Sally Ann Atkinson, she was actually on the Australian committee for Brisbane getting the 92 Olympics, but we didn't get it in the end. But anyway, that's another story.
Well, I guess it's just another example of where the Olympics and World's Fairs collide.
Well, I think even the city of Birmingham, England, was trying to, you know, tout themselves for the Olympics, and they had to paint it on the side of a canal boat sitting out there. So lots of people were seeing it. I mean, why not? If you've got half the world coming there and you want to get yourself in people's mind, obviously that's why a lot of companies and countries go to the World's Fair in the first place, is to, you know, get people to come and visit them.
And also looking through your book, I noticed that the Germany Pavilion had what they called a trans-rapid maglev train. And I hadn't quite made the connection between it and the maglev in Shanghai until I'd seen your book.
Yeah, that was another technology that everybody had high hopes for. And, you know, it worked well in small distances. And then as people started scaling them out, it just didn't become economically feasible. Now, years later, that the price of oil has continued to skyrocket, some of these things that were kind of put on the back burner 20, 25 years ago are becoming much more economically viable than they were back then. So both the speed, the lower, you know, maintenance on them are things that people wanted to do, and now that they can get the cost of the energy down to run it compared to the price of the fuel oil to do a conventional train, I think we're going to see a bunch more of these, you know, high-tech systems start coming into fruition. I'm a big train nut, so I'm hoping to be able to ride on them. When I rode the maglev system in Japan in 85 and then in the one in Expo 86, it was like, okay, it's here, it's ready to go, and you just don't see them out in your neighborhood just yet.
Yeah, I'm a big fan as well, especially, you know, modern contemporary trains. So when I was in Shanghai, I didn't get a chance to ride the maglev train from the airport because it had already closed by the time my flight had gotten in. I'm really interested in seeing what sort of technology, you know, what transportation they have on the site in Shanghai. So, you know,
yeah, they were actually they were just going to extend that maglev in Shanghai, weren't they, to the neighboring city of Hangzhou, weren't they? But it was but they couldn't go ahead because of some corruption trial or something about the fact that they were worried about electronic radiation, or what? Did you hear anything about that, Urso?
My understanding is that they were going to extend it to the Expo site, the Expo 2010 site.
Oh, right.
And that there were concerns from the public about electromagnetic radiation, and which are pretty much unfounded if you understand the technology, but those fears are there nonetheless. But I think it was probably unwise anyway, because even though the airport will be very busy during Expo 2010, and of course the site will be really busy during Expo 2010, if you think about it logistically, no one goes from the airport to the Expo site. Everyone goes from the airport to their hotel to the Expo site, back to their hotel,
yeah,
and then back to the airport. So
that's very funny then you're mentioning that, Urso, because actually it's very interesting, these huge infrastructure projects and World Expos and Olympic Games, etc. And for the Seville Expo in 92, one of the big things was that they had the Alta Velocidad Española, the speed train from Madrid down to Seville, which was open for the 92 Expo year in Seville. And they actually did build a station for the AVE at the Expo site. So what you could do is you could come into the central station in Seville, and then you could just continue on the line to the Expo site. So it does have a precedent, even though it may seem strange. But sadly enough, a lot of the Expo 92 site now is just really in ruins, and the Expo AVA station isn't being used, and there are weeds growing up everywhere, and there's a group in Seville which looks at the heritage of the Expo, and they're trying to do things about it, run by a fellow called Albert Martin. But that Expo station in Seville has just, it's really nothing now.
Well, let's think what happened with Expo 67. You know, they built a whole train line out there to service the islands, and that didn't last very long after Expo pulled out. Now I bet people are wishing they could put it back out there. Actually, I guess they've extended to the metro, if I remember. I haven't taken that out there in recent years, but people do build these things, and I don't think sometimes they think out in advance that once the ridership of the fare is gone, how do you keep these things economically viable? Who's going to pay for the maintenance and the security and everything for people to go and look at a disused site? And I think that's what one of the things that helped on Vancouver was that the train that serviced the expo site was sort of an incidental. It was, they needed it anyway to do the mass transit of the Vancouver area, so it wasn't a make or break it that it had a rider survive on just the fare ridership.
Yeah,
and luckily it's still there today.
Yeah, when I visited Vancouver, the SkyTrain is just invaluable to be able to get around. And I can't imagine Vancouver without it now.
No, super system. It really, really is good. It does a job. You know, they've expanded it since then, and it's really kind of a pleasure to see it there.
Yeah. Well, we mentioned BC Place, and we mentioned BC Place Stadium. We mentioned Canada Place, which is the Canadian Pavilion. We mentioned the Expo Center, which is the big geodesic dome people have probably seen. That's now the TELUS Science Center. There's also the BC Pavilion, which was still there, which was left over. But pretty much the rest of the site is now gleaming glass condo towers.
Up to about a year ago, you could still see the remnants of the gate area across from the BC Place. You know, there's the whole British Columbia complex, and yeah. they tore that down. That was the area with the big glass roof over it.
Yeah, the Plaza of Nations.
Is that right? Yeah. And that was there until about a year and a half ago, and it just got, again, it wore down. It was supposed to be a temporary, thing for Expo, and then it lasted for years. But, you can't take these temporary things and keep extending the life. It just becomes cost prohibitive after a while. And then you look at the price of the real estate underneath some of these artifacts, like you mentioned, all the glass and, steel towers and everything, that piece of empty, useless land where Expo was built, boy, that sure became a pretty nice piece of real estate these days. So getting Canadian National Rail and the others out of there, the city really turned that junkyard into a real gem of a piece of the city.
Well, as I've been bringing out all my Expo 86 stuff out this week and watching the images from Vancouver and looking up sort of contemporary images of the Vancouver skyline and aerial shots, I keep noticing, if you look at the aerial shots during the Expo site, there really was nothing on False Creek, before Expo 86. And so the downtown sort of tapered off as it went toward False Creek. But now not only is the Expo site, home of all these glass skyscrapers, but even the space between that and the center of downtown has all filled in. You wouldn't even recognize it as the same city. It's really Vancouver really, came of age with Expo 86, and it's kind of fun to see the Olympics sort of celebrating that.
I think this is something probably both of you are aware of, and since we're talking about post Expo redevelopments, I think I should and their success and the ones that have been successful. Not every post-expo development has been successful, but I think in Brisbane's case with South Bank Parklands, we had a successful template. You were mentioning all the condos and high rises at the Expo 86 site, and that was actually a plan for Brisbane's Expo 88 as well, but that was knocked back to create a parkland. But there is still some significant apartment space and hotel space at the back of the corridor of the Expo 88 site, but the majority of it is parkland, and it's a wonderful legacy from Expo 88.
Yeah, I think if a fair can leave a park behind, I'd personally rather see it leave a park behind than, just more apartments or condos.
Yeah, I mean, but if they do a good job redeveloping the Expo site, they can turn an eyesore and a really sort of disused part of the city into a wonderful focus, new focus for the city. So, but as I said, with some other Expo sites, they haven't had so much luck.
Well, I think part of it is trying to come up with a plan and have that plan ready to go when the Expo's ended, because when it ends, and then you're starting to scratch your head, what do I do now? It's too late, because there's going to be a significant period of time before people start doing things. And I think that's one of the things that helps some cities and doesn't help others is that, you know, you get all the excitement about building this thing, and then now what? And I think that's sort of like why, like in Flushing Meadows in New York, the park is nice, but it's not what it was supposed to be, because they got to the end and said, oh, we're out of money, you know, tear everything down, here's the keys, we're leaving. And there just wasn't the money, like put in escrow or put aside to guarantee that the post-fair park was going to be built the way it was supposed to be. It was just always assumed that somehow it would happen, and it just didn't come off the way that they had hoped. And a lot of other cities have had the same problem.
You know, a few episodes ago, John and I talked about some of our favorite pavilions at expos, and I mentioned the Canada Pacific Pavilion, which you mentioned had the Rainbow Wars in it. So I'm going to put you on the spot completely and ask you, like, what are your two or three favorite pavilions that you, that if you could go back in time and tell someone that they had to see, what would they be?
One of the ones, I guess, would be the USSR Pavilion. I had the pleasure of working on the space program when I first got out of college, although I was on unmanned missiles. So I was always a big fan. All through, you know, school, I was a, you know, fan of the John Glenn days and Apollo and all the rest of that. So I was a real fan of the space program, and I contrasted the U.S. Pavilion versus the USSR. I have to say I was really kind of enamored with the USSR Pavilion, that it was just a lot more to see, a lot more to do, and it kind of made me more interested in that. It made me feel disloyal as an American that, of course, I should, you know, just love the American Pavilion more. But being a technology-oriented guy, I thought the USSR Pavilion had, you know, a certain amount of pizzazz there. As I mentioned earlier, I did enjoy this, Spirit Lodge, the GM Pavilion, and trying to figure out, you know, how some of those things were done in the story. Rainbow Wars was a lot of fun. One of my favorite areas, though, frankly, wasn't a real pavilion so much as it was a section, the Marine Plaza, all the ships that were on display.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Really enjoyed that because a lot of the ships had their crews that were there, and to me that's one of the part I really enjoy about fairs is not just looking at the exhibits or, you know, looking at the steel and concrete, but sitting down and talking to the people. And it was kind of fun to go down to the harbor and talk to the people that, you know, like, oh, my God, I can't believe you brought that ship all the way across the ocean. Or, you know, did you come over in a container ship? No, you sailed it. You know, it was kind of fun to talk to them. And I really enjoy what cities that do things right with water. And I think Vancouver is a wonderful city that has done that as opposed to L.A. where, you know, too much is just industrial ports. So the whole Marine Plaza area was frankly, was one of the lower key areas, but it was one of my favorites. It was just a lot going on and a real chance to talk to people from places around the world I enjoyed.
Well, you know, we've been talking about Expo 86 almost exclusively, with a few side notes here and there. But your experience with World's Fair is rather long, and I think you mentioned Flushing Meadow. Wasn't New York in 1964 or 65? Was that your first one?
Yeah, I grew up in Brooklyn, so I wasn't far from the fair site at all. And then I moved out to Long Island, and we kept watching the fair being built. And one of my uncles actually worked on the fair grounds and would come home and tell us all these crazy things they were building. And I walked through the gate. I was 12 years old the first time I walked through in 1964, and it was wow.
I just couldn't
believe what I was looking at. I mean, what I had seen from the parkway was good enough, but to actually walk through that gate and you know, I spent every moment for the next 2 years that I could possibly find a way to, you know, scavenge the money to get out there. And that was really the thing that was sort of the genesis. I had an aunt who traveled a lot, and she'd been to Expo 58 and shared us pictures and movies, and she'd been to the 62 fair, again, pictures and movies, but to experience it on the first hand. And then shortly thereafter to be able to go up to Expo 67, and wow, you know, at that point, I'm in heaven. I'm thinking there's a World's Fair coming every couple of years. And then this drought hit. But I'm very lucky. I had a job, as I mentioned, I traveled extensively, and when you go over to Europe once a month, and in between I'd be down in Japan, and it really just happened at times that I had lost track of, you know, World's Fairs because, you know, you get involved with your family and business and all the rest of that, and you're in Japan and somebody mentions the World's Fair, and you go, really, there's a World's Fair? Oh, well, I know where I'm going tonight. I was lucky to go to a number of them and be able to, in several cases, go back more than once, which was nice, that you don't feel as rushed and you could spend time with it. So the 64 was the first one. It's still sort of like, the one you never forget. But I've enjoyed quite a few of the others, and I'm looking forward to the 2010 experience as well.
So just for the point of bragging rights, how many World's Fairs have you been to?
Oh, goodness. I kind of hit a drought after 86 was the last one for a while. I had been in Australia, and I was hoping to go to the 88 one, and unfortunately somebody got sick at work, and I had to fill in for them, so I missed it. I was there the final week, and tells you don't put off today what you can do a different day, that's for sure. So then I was at the account, things like the Millennium Dome. I was some of the minor ones. But I really haven't been to a World's Fair per se since Expo 86. It's you hit the things with families and the kids in the school and all the rest of it, and you have a choice of picking them up and putting them on a 14-hour flight, or do you take them to Disneyland? Sometimes you take the easier of the two.
Yeah, well, I hope you can make it out to Shanghai for 2010.
I'm looking forward to it. My son is getting ready to go to college this year, and as soon as he's packed off to college, I'm off to Shanghai.
Oh, okay.
I'm probably going to be there near the end of it, but that way you guys can get all the bugs out when you go earlier.
Well, I was talking with Alfred Heller, who I'm also hoping we'd have on this podcast soon. He lives here in the Bay Area, and his first World's Fair was in 1939-40 in San Francisco, and he was telling me he's planning on going to Shanghai, and it'll be his 19th one.
Wow.
And it just amazes me. It's like we have a long way to catch up.
It was interesting because I was doing things like I was going back to Germany a lot, and I was over in Germany probably 8-9 times in 2000, and I just heard so many bad things about Hanover, and then after a while you say, if I'm overseas and I'm missing the family so much, do I really want to detour for the time and expense to go to something that everybody's telling me is not so good? I'll get it on the next trip, and you just put things off and time goes by. But everything I see from 2010 is if I miss it, I'll be kicking myself for a long period of time.
Yeah, I've mentioned on this podcast before that we're looking forward to seeing it, and I'm still waiting to find out the details, so I have nothing to announce yet, but I may be there the entire 6 month of the run, so I'm really, really, really hoping that happens.
Congratulations. Hope it does.
And I visited the site in September, and I've been champing at the bit to get back there. But before the expo runs, I guess I could mention that as well. I'm freelance writing for China Daily, so my first article has appeared in China Daily, so there will be more of those to come as well if anyone happens to pick up an issue, look for my name. Hopefully there'll be more of that to come, and hopefully more announcement.
That's interesting that you mentioned that, Urso, because you can also find that article online. I went into the China Daily website and I did a search for your name in the search box, and I got your article, so I was very impressed.
Yeah. Well, while I'm at the shameless bragging plugging part of the podcast, I should also mention that I don't know when it will be shown in the United States, but a local production company is doing a 6-part series called Shanghai 2010, and they interviewed me for that as well, and that's going to be on PBS stations sometime in March. So hopefully I'll have more information about that.
I'll be sure to tell us.
So it's kind of crude for me to plug myself when we have a guest. But so while we're at the plugging part of the podcast, tell us some of the books that you've done and some of your projects. I'm mostly familiar with the books that you did for Arcadia Publishing as well as your website. So tell us a little bit about how you got started doing that and where to find you there.
Yeah, I'd be glad to. As I mentioned, I've been taking pictures forever. I was the designated family photographer, so I had all these pictures and, nothing to do with them. They were all sitting in boxes or whatever. And a fellow named Bill Young, who has the excellent site NYWF64, announced he was going to do a World's Fair site. So I got in touch with Bill and said, hey, if you need pictures to help illustrate it, got this one, helped that one. So So he and I kept up a nice email correspondence, and then we actually met our one and only time back at the fair site when he put together a mini convention there a number of years ago. Called me up one day and said, hey, I got approached about doing a book. I think I know a lot about the fair. I don't have a lot of pictures. Would you like to get together? So Bill and I have actually done two books on the 64 World's Fair, and we're in touch all the time. And again, we met one day, and that's it. You know, it just kind of shows you how you can bring the world together electronically. The first 64 book did very well. Arcadia basically told us it sold about six times what their normal book sales go. So they said, what else would you guys like to do? So we said, well, another book, and that would be fun. How about one on the New Orleans World's Fair? How about one on Expo 86? Now I'm doing one for them on the 1962 Seattle World's Fair. And along the way, they said, we'd like to do some calendars. And I don't know if you saw that the calendar we did for them for last year, it evidently sold so well that Barnes & Noble said that they need another 2011 calendar based on the 64 fair.
So well, your 2010 calendar I have is right by my side. If this were a video podcast, I would point the camera at it right now.
Well, you can tell me that and I'll believe you. Thank you. But, I've had a lot of fun doing it. I do computer stuff all day long for a living, and the writing is something I enjoy. I wrote a book on the history of Disney television a number of years ago, and I've done a lot of freelance work for Disney since I left them full-time. And I enjoy the writing, and I really enjoy the World's Fair books because, frankly, they're more fun for me to do probably than for somebody to read, because I really get to sit back and look at, like, on the 64 fair, I have over 20,000 photos of it.
Wow.
So distilling that down to the ones for the book, it gives me a big excuse to spend a lot of time looking at pictures again. And it's a lot of fun to turn the clock back and kind of be selfish and, I'm back in 1964 and I'm 12 years old again. I'm enjoying it.
Wow. That's more photos than I could even imagine, and more scanning than I can imagine as well.
Thank God for a very patient wife.
So as we wrap up this podcast, a lot of people are watching Vancouver on TV. Now that they listen to this podcast, they'll be looking for a little hints of Expo 86 in the background and look at Vancouver and just how much Expo 86 means to Vancouver. I'm hoping we have a lot of listeners from Edmonton. And some people might be wondering why I'm wondering about Edmonton. Edmonton, as I imagine you know, is bidding for Expo 2017. And there are, a lot of questions about what this means for Edmonton and what would it mean for them to host Expo 2017.
One thing I'd offer if anybody in Edmonton's listening is the advice of one thing I think the Expo 86 people did very well. The fellow that ran a good portion of Expo 86, Jim Pattison, made the determination that this was not going to be just the Vancouver World's Fair. It was going to be British Columbia's World's Fair that happened to be in Vancouver. And he put a real effort into outreach across the whole area, flying up to all these little villages and trying to get those people to go. And the whole basic pitch was, why don't you come and volunteer to be here for a week? Well, if your daughter was going to volunteer to be there for a week, of course you were going to go, and you'd bring your cousins and your relatives and all the rest of it. And it really helped, I think, make it more of an event that the local citizens, the people were behind, as opposed to just corporations and paid staff that's going to get bored and they're just going to be selling whatever they're selling. I think that was really, to me, the big difference between a lot of other things I've been at, was that people were there because they wanted to be there. They were volunteering. Matter of fact, they had to pay their own way to be there. But they really wanted to be part of the experience. And I think the volunteer force and what Pattison put together really helped put Expo on the map. It wasn't just blasé carnival workers that had flown up there and gotten a job. It was real Canadians that were proud of their cities. And if Edmonton can catch that spark in a bottle, I know I'll be there.
Mm. Well, that'll be an interesting challenge given the sort of contentious relationship between Edmonton and Calgary to pull together.
Yeah, that's going to be a challenge.
But I have such high hopes for Edmonton. And I'm hoping that we have listeners from Edmonton who are trying to find out what exactly is this whole World's Expo thing.
Yeah, and I should mention that I just had a quick look at their website, the Expo 2017 website, the other day, and I was really impressed. They've got some really nice stuff there, and they've got these two promotional videos which go for about 3 minutes, and they're putting into a lot of work into this theme of harmony of energy in our future planet, like human energy, knowledge energy, renewable energy, power energy, and creative energy. It's very interesting to see how they've articulated that theme into those different sub-themes. But, yeah, you should definitely, people who are listening should definitely have a look at the Edmonton Expo 2017.com website and have a look at some of those PR videos.
I'll be heading there tonight. You sold me.
And also, those videos are worth seeing also because there's a lot of footage from Expo 67 and Expo 86.
Well, I really appreciate the opportunity. I, like I said, as a writer, you do these things, you know, sort of in a vacuum. I send out drafts, you know, get people's corrections and that. But it's, you know, I'm taking my violin here. It's a lonely existence, but it's something I really enjoy. It, like I said, I met my wife at Disney, and I went to work for Disney because that's how much fun I had at the World's Fair. And you know, to me, it's the whole. It's not just the buildings which I enjoy. It's the whole spirit, and it's just like the Olympics. It's the energy, and that's why I really enjoy being able to chat about these things.
Well, I really appreciate having you on here, and I really hope we can get you back on here because I also want to talk about 64, 65 New York, 67 Montreal. With the stuff that you're doing for Seattle 1962, I'm particularly interested in that expo and that site. We just have to have you on here again. I hope we can have you back on. I want to thank you so much.
Well, I'd love to do it, and thanks both of you for making the time available for me. I appreciate it.
Well, you're
thanks.
Quite welcome. So as we wrap things up, I've mentioned many times on this podcast before that you can reach me at Urso@expomuseum.com and John at foundationexpo88.org. Of course, our sites are expomuseum.com and foundationexpo88.org. So where can people find you, Bill?
Very easily named worldsfairphotos.com. I basically, you know, try to go off and take the highlight of each fair, and I never have the time to update the site as much as I'd like. But I've tried to put down a little, you know, bit of what I thought were the best shots of 1939 fair or the 64 or whatever. And, you know, I'll keep updating it. Like I said, with 20,000 photos, I spend more time scanning and going, ooh, I remember that than I do updating the site. I need to get better.
Yeah, I've run into the same thing. I'm currently putting some materials together for a book and presentation about World's Fair branding and visual identity. And, you know, I start pulling books out, and then I find myself an hour later realizing I was just browsing and oohing and aahing in my books, not actually doing any research. So,
yeah, I find I'll look at a picture and I'll see something I hadn't seen before, and then I start saying, "Oh, where? How did I miss that?" And next thing you know, you spend 2 hours looking at monorail pictures, and the website sits there blinking, unupdated. Well, again, thanks for your time. Appreciate it.
You're quite welcome. We're also John and I are both on Twitter. My Twitter is at twitter.com/expomuseum, and John is at fexpo88. F as in foundation on Twitter. Are you involved in Twitter or anything like that?
No, my daughter's told me if I get involved with Twitter, Facebook, or any of those, she'll disown me.
Well, again, I'd like to apologize for the poor audio quality in that podcast. I think we have things worked out, and it shouldn't crop up again in future episodes. To end this podcast, I thought I'd include a song from my own collection that is from Expo 86. I specifically remember this song because I was 19 years old when I visited Expo 86, and it was in the Canadian Pavilion. The name of the song is This Is My Home. It was by a composer named Bob Buckley. And it was only in recent years that I discovered that Bob Buckley has a website and includes this song on his website. So I wrote to him this week, asked him if I could add it onto the podcast, and he consented. So I'm proud to present to many people who haven't heard it the song This Is My Home, which when I heard it, I got that stirring feeling of pride in being Canadian that I know many Canadians feel. slightly before realizing that I'm not Canadian myself. But it's one of those very stirring anthems that you'll often hear in World's Fair pavilions. And I think this one is one of the more successful ones.
Et des pouvoirs créateurs.